from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Tonight we're going to tackle polygamy. We're going to talk about it. We're going to interview a couple of authors who have written about it. And then a little bit later on, we're going to talk to Jane. And who's Jane? Well, I'm not going to tell you who Jane is. Jane is living in seclusion. She's a rape victim. She's been terrorized. She's afraid for her life. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. And then Scott Michaels will be here a little bit later on. He is producing a new documentary on Charles Manson, and if that doesn't make the hair on the back of your neck stand up, I don't know what will. I read an article here recently called Polygamy Revisited. I'm going to share a little bit of it with you. It says, it's not like being born in the U.S. It's like being born in another country, says Joseph, who more than a decade ago fled a polygamous town in Utah. I think of my life being caught up in the Holocaust, and like being caught up in the Holocaust. And when you compare your life to being caught up in the Holocaust, that's something else. I have the author of the article, and of course she has a new book out called Singularity. Her name's Catherine Casey, and I encourage you to go to her webpage at www.catherinecasey.com. Welcome to the program, ma'am.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this, and maybe it's just me, but I think the mainstream media has done a terrible job when it's come to reporting polygamy, educating the people across North America about polygamy. The stats are incredible. Of course, we saw some coverage with the FLDS compound in Texas, El Dorado, Texas, and the children that were seized and then going to be returned and all this sort of stuff. But what caught my eye was the article that you wrote, your experience with investigating and writing about polygamy, and then interviewing the young lad, what's his name, KC, or no, I'm sorry, Joseph, you're KC, and let's talk about the article.
Okay, well, I was in Colorado City, Arizona, and Hilldale, Utah, which spanned the Short Creek area, right on the border between two states, back in the early 90s, reporting on a case, and met quite a few people there at that time, and I was really stunned by how odd in a society it is in our nation. It's like nothing I'd ever seen before.
You know, I just watched a documentary called Banking on Heaven, and a little bit later on we're going to talk to Andrea Moore Emmett, who wrote a book called God's Brothel that continues on with the investigation into polygamy. And talking about this Colorado City, it's something that people, Catherine, probably would never believe. They'd, you know, this is the United States, this is Canada, these sorts of places don't exist, but they're there.
Well, this is these two cities or towns are built in really inhospitable territory, and they don't want strangers there, and they're very insulated, and they are controlled by the church, by this branch of the church, this FLDS church. Actually, the people in El Dorado, Texas, came from Hilldale in Colorado City.
When you hear about polygamy, you think about Warren Jeffs, of course, the polygamous cult leader who was arrested and convicted on a rape charge, who is now serving time in a penitentiary, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, and probably still making millions and millions of dollars, while these poor women who have discarded their sons because the sons are considered competition, but continue to raise their daughters, and some fathers are fathering hundreds of children, but they're living on green stamps. It's just so sad. There's drugs involved, there's rape, you name it. Let's talk about your interview with Joseph, one of the boys. He says in a question that you ask him, when you look back on your life, what do you remember? I thought this was fascinating when he answers, the way we were all indoctrinated and brainwashed. And again, most people are not going to believe this, but it's true.
It is true. Joseph talked about being deprived of sleep and of food and of being manipulated by his parents and the people within the community. He's one of what's considered to be the lost boys. In order to have these ratios to have one man with 15 wives, you have to get rid of a lot of the boys. And he was driven out at a young age.
And basically, you know, I use the term they're considered as competition. They're driven out, but there's a big criminal element involved in this too. And we have to sit back and wonder. Yeah, we hear about the case in Texas, and we've heard about other cases, but it seems like government and some government officials in North America have this leery attitude when it comes to polygamy, as far as stepping on someone's considered to be freedom of religion, where it's a lot bigger than that, and it's a lot scarier than that.
Well, these are really difficult cases to prosecute, Dana. Back in 52, when they had the 1952, they had the Short Creek raid.
Right.
Came in from both sides, from Arizona and Utah, and they made wholesale arrests. They never were able to prosecute anyone because none of the women would testify against their husbands. Since then, the men are only legally marrying the first wife. And after that, there's spiritual union.
Right.
And now this El Dorado situation has developed, and the articles in the paper are again saying that authorities are having a difficult time finding anyone to testify. Without a victim ready to step forward or willing to step forward, we may end up with no prosecutions at all out of this case.
You know, if we can't protect our children, Catherine Casey is here, author Catherine Casey. We're talking about polygamy, if you're just tuning in. If we can't protect our children, I'm not sure who we can protect. But when the public sees the broadcasts on the cable networks, the mainstream media shows, in the newspapers, the internet, you see the quaint outfits that the ladies wear. They're saying they want their children back, and they seem to be crying, but I'm not seeing tears. I'm seeing, you know, and you look at, again, the term is indoctrinated, brainwashed people. What can we, Catherine, in the media do besides what we're trying to do and what I'm trying to do here as far as educating the people? Because this is a big problem. We're talking about thousands of people, tens of thousands across North America, Canada, Mexico, wherever.
Well, you know, I think the important thing, Dana, is what you're doing in allowing people to tell their stories, to say what it is really like. Because, you know, we look at shows like HBO's Big Love, and it seems pretty quaint most of the time. It doesn't seem like it's all that threatening. But in real-life practice, these people are living in towns where the church controls the entire town. And when there is abuse in a family, I'm not saying all these families are abusive.
No.
But when there is abuse in a family, these children have nowhere to go. They can't go to the police department because the police are part of the FLDS church.
Yep.
Everyone is connected.
When you write a story like this, mm-hmm. or you write any story, and again, you end up in a location like Colorado City, and again, watching some of the documentaries that I've watched and seeing some of the reaction of the people and how the interviewers were followed and how they were questioned and how the people who were there covering the story were so happy to get out of that community. Mm-hmm. I'm curious your thoughts on when you were there. Did you find that also?
It's a very uncomfortable place to be. I remember walking up to a household. There were these huge houses where the husband lived with the original, perhaps two or three wives. And they were on large parcels of land, 4 or 5 acres. All the land belongs to the church. People build their homes but don't really own the land. And all around the perimeter of the land were smaller houses where the other wives lived. And some of these men had 15, 20 wives.
Wow.
And I would walk up to one. I'm directionally challenged. I got lost, and I needed directions. I was trying to find a particular household. And I walked up to a couple of the houses, and the women were outside playing with the children. From the time I got out of my car till I walked to the front gate, they had vanished, just disappeared. It was the oddest thing. They're so wary of strangers. I was watched the entire time I was there. I had a very difficult time. I did find people that would talk to me about the downside of polygamy, but they do try to manage the media.
and intimidate the media. And, well, this is one program on one host that won't be intimidated, because I believe the word needs to get out, and we're going to try and cover it as much as we can.
Okay.
Here on the program, if you're just tuning in, author Catherine Casey is here, and I encourage you to go to her webpage at www.catherine, CatherineKaseyCasey, that's all one word, .com. You know, getting in to a polygamous cult, you know, we're either working undercover, law enforcement, like you say, a lot of them are involved. You need to bring in someone from the outside to try and get in on the inside to try and build a case, and we'll talk more about that later. But someone who is near and dear to your heart is a person by the name of Sarah Armstrong, and that takes us right into Singularity. Tell me about Sarah.
Oh, Sarah is my Texas Ranger. I've been writing true crime books and real murder mysteries for 20 years, and I finally decided it would be fun to make it all up, so I did some Singularity.
And tell me about the book. I'm reading. There's a new ranger in town, and she's profiler Sarah Armstrong. Let's hope she'll be around for a good long while. And you know, to have people be able to sit back and have a hero, I guess, for lack of a better term, is always a good thing. And it will draw the readers. Let's talk about Singularity and what it's all about.
Well, it's a case about a single mom raising a 12-year-old daughter living on a ranch outside Houston with her mom, and she happens to be a Texas Ranger profiler, and it's the story of how she goes after a killer. It starts out with a dual killing or a double killing on Galveston Island, and it becomes just this very bizarre, twisted case that she has to piece together.
And when you sit down and you pick up a character, or create a character, I'm not sure the proper lingo to use here, how do you come up with a character like you came up with? Is this something to you? You hear about the creative songwriter who in the middle of the night gets up and he has to start writing song lyrics out on a napkin. Is this something that happens with you? All of a sudden, Catherine Casey is having a meal and all of a sudden she starts writing on the tablecloth some ideas she gets?
Sometimes, Dana, yeah, it's a little bit like that. It's, you know, I've spent an awful lot of time with police officers in the last 20 years.
Oh, they're a good group, yeah.
They are. I like them. And they're fun, and I've learned a lot about their jobs and what they do and why they do what they do. So it just, when I decided to write fiction, it just made sense to write about a police officer. And I wanted the character to be able to cover the entire state. So, you know, the Texas Rangers are just perfect because Texas is such a wonderful and such a strange place.
You know, one last question before I let you go, and it's been a big kick to have you on the program, and
hopefully
we'll have you on again soon, is when you see media coverage about police officers, whether it's in Texas or wherever, we see a lot of the negatives. You know, we see the Drew Petersons, and we see the other police officers or ex-police officers that have been accused of a crime or accused of brutality. We don't hear or see or read a lot of stories about the good ones. You know, they're 99.999% of them are good ones. And yeah, there's that bad apple out there. We all admit that. But is it tough for you not to talk about or to write about, or maybe you have, about the bad cop?
Well, I wrote a book called A Warrant to Kill about a bad cop years ago, and he was truly a bad cop. But I've written many other books and magazine articles for 20 years, and as you said, most of the police officers I've met have been absolutely fantastic people. They work so hard, they get really so little in return, and they're really out there, you know, trying to help. They're trying to you know, make the world a little better place for us.
And they, well, brother and sister officers and authors like you, Catherine Casey, are doing great work, and I appreciate you coming on the program.
Thanks so much.
We'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with author Andrea Moore Emmett. She's written a book called God's Brothel, The Extortion of Sex for Salvation in Contemporary Mormon and Christian Fundamentalist Polygamy, and the Stories of 18 Women Who Escaped. You got to stay tuned for this one. And then a little bit later on, Jane will join us. And Jane, obviously, is a made-up name. Jane is in seclusion. Jane was raped. She was terrorized. Jane is worried about her life and the life of her family. And we're going to talk to her about that and about how we can do more and how governments can do more to protect those that are victims. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
All right, we're back in our continuing investigation into polygamy and the lack thereof of the mainstream media and the education of the public. Like, really, when it comes down to this, the mainstream media has done a poor job when it comes to the investigation and the education of the public about polygamy. There's a book called God's Brothel. I'm going to share a little description of it for you. The Extortion of Sex for Salvation in Contemporary Mormon and Christian Fundamentalist Polygamy, and the Stories of 18 Women Who Escaped. And the author is Andrea Moore Emmett. And, you know, this is about time that we started to do these types of programs. And you heard Catherine Casey earlier talking about her experiences and her investigation and writing into this. And I thought I'd bring on another author. And again, the book is called God's Brothel. And if you go to the website polygamy.org, you can find information on it there, or just go to amazon.com. And of course, we'll have a link to it on our page. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
You know, when you start talking about Mormon and Christian fundamentalist polygamy, besides being a huge mouthful, that right. is something that the public really doesn't understand. You know, we saw a little bit about Warren Jeffs, and it was more about him being arrested. And then you get the talk. I call them the talking heads, the lawyers that come on to who really have no expertise in this matter, but they look at whether or not he did commit an offense, whether or not he didn't commit an offense. But it's a huge North American problem. Let's start with the book God's Brothel, and then we'll get into about the actual polygamists and how they're, you know, they're everywhere.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I wrote the book. I was living in Salt Lake City at the time, writing other stories, and I came across a lot of information about polygamy. At the time that I started researching polygamy, everybody thought, well, they're just hardworking people, quaint people living their religious freedom, and they're, you know, what, why bother them?
Right.
Live and let live. And in this country, and in all of North America, we have a high tolerance for religious belief. So, you know, fine, they can do that. They're not hurting anybody. But what I was finding out was that not only are they hurting anybody, hurting people, but children and women are having civil rights violated, human rights violated. Women are, and girls are being trafficked across state lines and into other countries, Canada, Mexico. And there's atrocious abuses. They're crime families. It's organized crime, and it's pedophilia at its worst. Institutionalized pedophilia.
It's described on your website here as a growing phenomenon within 30 United States, Canada, and Mexico, more akin to sexual slavery than to quaint, harmless lifestyles or religious choice. You know, when we saw the coverage on the Texas compound, for example, and you know, you would see the mothers in their garb, and I'm not sure of the proper term to use, and you know, the quaintness of it as you describe, but the horror is so rampant that
right.
this covers, you know, across North America. And in your book God's Brothel, you tell the story of 18 women who escaped, and let's touch on that a little bit.
Okay. Well, the thing that people might not understand is that the FLDS in Texas, Utah, Arizona, South Dakota, Canada, and Mexico are just one of many groups, and there's a lot of independent families also living this way. So this, there's at least 13 main groups, and then different ones spring up all the time and start with following and grow and grow. And because they believe that women are supposed to have a child per year, women are a vessel to be worn out in childbirth, they're growing unbelievably. The Kingston group in Salt Lake City, for instance, is made up of just seven main men. There's a lot of other men, but the seven main men, just between them, have hundreds and hundreds of children. I mean, one man alone has over 200 children, one man that I know.
Wow.
So they're producing incredibly. And then there's other ones who also proselytize and pull women in to the group because they need women. So they grow and they grow, and they are a huge problem. They're living off of subsidies off of the states and the federal government, and the problems that come out of there when boys are kicked out because boys are competition for marriageable girls,
right,
become society's problems. And the girls that eventually, some of them do get away, they become society's problems. The social problems reverberate across all of society, and we all have to deal with that eventually.
You know, our society today is somewhat sheltered, and unless you really research, I watched a video here the other day called Banking on Heaven,
right.
Unless you really started to look and started to talk about and started to, like I say, research, you wouldn't really understand this whole aspect of polygamy. The Warren Jeffs out there, and like you say, it's a much broader picture. But you talk about 18 women who escaped. You just didn't get on the phone and phone and say, hi, did you escape from a polygamous compound? Would you like to talk to me?
You know, those 18 women were just ones that were representative stories. I interviewed so many people, men, women, and children, both in and out. I have done years and years and years of research, and I've gone into the compounds. I was also the researcher for an A&E documentary that also ran on the BBC, and I've stayed in the compounds. You know, I've been there, talked to the leaders of these groups. The thing that in this Texas case that I think that people really need to have their ears, you know, on their radar just open for is that this is constantly trying to be framed and put in a context of religion and parent rights.
Right.
And whenever a cult expert, a psychiatrist in a court case, has to go to court on these kinds of cases, the minute religion or religious beliefs or how religious coercion works on women and children's behavior and men's behavior, the judges will just shut down. They just dismiss it right away. They don't want to hear that religion is causing some kind of deviant behavior. The thing in our country, in America, and I believe also in Canada, you know, you can practice, you can believe what you want to believe. You can believe anything, but you can't practice everything if it's against a law, a valid law.
You know,
we wouldn't want people throwing a virgin into a volcano because of their religious beliefs.
Exactly.
You know, and polygamy is one of those crimes that society has said, no, that's against the law. And so, you know, to allow this to go on in the name of religion and say, well, you know, we'll treat it like spitting on the sidewalk, against the law to spit on the sidewalk, it's one of those laws that we just don't prosecute. And so these people have been allowed to grow and grow, and living outside the law, they say they live man's law, they live God's law, not man's law, excuse me. So anything they want to do goes under that purview of they're above the law.
Is it a case of governments, whether they're state, local, federal? You know, we can talk about Colorado City, Utah. That's, you know, it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up when you hear about that place. And others just being so afraid to attack that doctrine of freedom of religion, or is it just the governments don't understand, they don't realize what's going on? You know, there's a lot of lip service, I guess, from governments, but when a whole city is practicing polygamy, right down to the judges, the law enforcement, to whatever, you know, how do you handle something like that?
Right. Well, it's a little of both. It's a little of the government not understanding all the dynamics, you know, and not understanding what is really happening. It is that fear of going after somebody on grounds that the religion is wrong. You know, how does government say what religion should be? How does government define religion? So, you know, rather than looking at the law and saying this behavior is illegal, they will just file it under a religious cloak. And that's how this has been able to be continue on and on and on. So, you know, that needs to be addressed, reframed, and looked at in a whole different kind of way, as far as government, as far as laws, legals. You know, the CPS and the laws protecting children and families was never written to be able to handle these numbers of children and these kind of dynamics. But it needs to be looked at in a whole new way.
When you start talking about freedom of religion, that's one thing. But again, quoting from your webpage, their horrifying stories involve drugs, rape, incest, orgies, and violence, slavery, you name it. And when you start talking about young children,
right.
and the boys, that whole aspect is one thing on its own. The young girls being married at such a young age and hundreds of children. Most people would say, ah, go on, that stuff doesn't happen. This is the United States of America. This is Canada. This is Mexico. Right. That's stuff that you see in the movies. But right. that sort of depiction is just so wrong. And what can we do in the media to try and correct it, to tell the people that these dangers are out there?
Well, the media has fallen to the old love bombing of a cult.
Yeah.
You know, they present themselves in a certain way that looks really good on TV. You know, the mothers crying for their children and complaining about their violation of parental rights. Well, what about the rights of the children? What about the rights of just plain human rights, just a human right to have an education, you know, which is acknowledged around the world, but not in these groups because of religion. So, you know, and for instance, what you mentioned, the young boys, you know, throwing the young boys out on the streets when they're about 13, 14, because they're competition for the marriageable girls.
Yep.
When has a leader, a state leader, or any agency ever prosecuted a parent for criminal neglect of a child, for abandoning their son?
Yep.
It's never happened. Why not? And why doesn't the media talk about this? They've fallen victim to, you know, the PR campaign of the polygamists, and it's been very effective. And a lot of civil rights groups or libertarian groups have come to the, you know, the aid of the polygamists. Yeah, these parental rights. But what about the rights of the child? What about the best interests of the child? Are we going to let another generation of and beyond continue this horror? When the raid happened on this particular group in 1953, there were just over 200 children that were removed and then sent back. Well, now in just one compound of the same group, there's over 400 children. And it looks like, you know, again, the PR campaign is going to send these children right back. And the judges who don't see that, you know, there's imminent danger to children and defer to the religious cloak that's being portrayed.
And you see the mothers that are living on food stamps, and yet Warren Jeffs is supposedly in jail, and he's controlling a multi-million, multi-million dollar cult, and that's my term.
Yeah. You know, Warren Jeffs has got the multi-millions, and these women and children are living in abject poverty.
Yeah.
And they're told that they need to learn how to live in poverty as Jesus was in poverty, and that it's refiner's fire. And so they, you know, they get their food stamps and oftentimes sell them and turn the money over to Warren Jeffs. And these men, they don't support these women and children. These women and children are working absolute slave labor, and they don't see any of this, any of the profit.
What we see now and what comes out, although very minimal in the media, is probably just basically touching the surface.
Right.
I'm sure you in your investigation and in your writing of your book, again, the book is God's Brothel, and just look on the website for a link to it. You must have heard stories that, you know, because of constraints as far as writing that you didn't get in the book. But if you could, just in our last couple of minutes here, share a quick story from one of the mothers that, you know, would make my audience sit back and say, wow.
Oh, there's just so many, and they're so heartbreaking. The women are so brainwashed, and in order to live this lifestyle, and it's generational. These women are generational. That's all they know. They are taught from the crib not to have any feelings. They don't have love. They don't have attachments. They're not bonded to their children. You know, the women you see on TV, if you notice, they're not crying tears.
No.
It's an act. I'm sure at some point, at some part of them, they care to have their children back, but the children are rotated between women so that there is no bonding. The children call them mother so-and-so, mother so-and-so, mother so-and-so, whatever their first name is. They don't really have an attachment to their birth mother. And so, I mean, how else can a mother allow her son to be thrown out in the streets at the age of 13?
Yeah.
How else can a mother allow to have a tiny baby be held under the water when it's crying? They have to break them. They break them from crying, because crying is a sign that you have an evil spirit. And so when a baby cries, they hold them under the water, under a faucet or in the tub, one or the other. The brutality that mothers witness of their children, they cut off all feelings. And they are cut off from feelings when they allow their husband to sleep with a 16-year-old and another and another. I mean, there are no emotions. And so these children have no protection. When the Texas authorities would ask these children who their parents were, and the children said they didn't know, they really didn't know. And people thought, oh, well, they're just trying to protect their parents. No, the children really don't know who their parents are.
Yeah.
So this is the kind of atmosphere that these little, innocent, vulnerable children are growing up with. And if this society and any society on this planet does not protect the most vulnerable of their citizens, then, you know, what are we doing?
Exactly, exactly. The book is God's Brothel, The Extortion of Sex for Salvation in Contemporary Mormon and Christian Fundamentalist Polygamy, and the story of 18 women who escaped. And the author, Andrea Moore Emmett, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Do you believe this is actually happening in today's society? Believe it. We'll be right back.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. My next guest, I'm going to call her Jane. Jane is living in seclusion somewhere. I'm going to protect her identity and the location where I'm speaking to her from. Jane is a rape victim. Jane has been terrorized, and Jane is afraid for her safety and the safety of her children right now. And what I thought I would do tonight is bring on Jane and talk to her, not specifically about her case, but about being a victim, about living a nightmare, living in terror, and what governments, what law enforcement, what counselors, what media people, what Joe and Mary Sixpack can do more to help, and I think it's so important to get that word out. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If I could get you just to speak up a little bit louder, please. You know, where do you start with something like this? I'm not trying to be flip. I'm trying to put the cards on the table, so to speak. Your husband raped you, correct?
Yes, he did.
A lot of people, and I think it's so important, when they look at marital rape, if I can use that term, they say, well, you know, in some of the older society and in some ethnic backgrounds, they will say that isn't it the wife's duty to comply? And that is so wrong, and I think that's something that we need to deal with right away, is to get that stigma out there and stop it, that a wife can be raped just the same as anyone else.
I'm sorry, did you ask me a question? I was just listening to
you. No, that's okay. You know, you're a wife and you were raped by your husband. That's such a huge stigma out there right now. A lot of people don't realize that, first of all, I think they understand that it happens, but there's still that aspect of society that thinks that it's okay.
Yeah, no, I've run into that many of times. Unfortunately, even through family and friends, why or how did this happen? What did I do to make him snap? Because we had just the perfect family, you know, from looking on the outside in. I got judged a lot. I got asked what I did as a person to make him do this to me. And it's very hard to answer that question to anybody when they're not in that position.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, there's that, I call it the blame game. And I think it's a human emotion for anyone. When they're in a position, and even as a rape victim, to think about that. And I know there's the cycle of violence we've talked about many times in this program, where it's human to say, well, maybe I did do something wrong, and it just must tear the psyche. It must tear the thoughts in your mind all up and terrible. Did you go through something like that?
I went through that every day. Every day I thought if I, you know, just did something else for him, or if I would hate to say aided him, but everything that I did, I basically did just so I wouldn't have to put up with that abuse, or my children didn't have to put up with that abuse. And I really didn't know I was doing that until I went to counseling. And it really kind of hit me in counseling, which I didn't take right away. I didn't talk about the case for a very long time, because it wouldn't even come out of my mouth. But when I went to counseling, I actually took a couple of domestic violence cases, and the very first time that I went to the class, I just sat there, and it was like I was smirking, and she looked at me and just said, "Why are you smirking?" And I just started crying, because I felt so naive, and I didn't understand why I put up with it so long.
Putting up with it, or what some would call, and again, I'm calling my guest Jane tonight because she is living in seclusion, and I am protecting her identity, a survival technique, Jane, a way to survive, because you know that you have to live day to day, and you have to try and save your children, and you really don't know how to escape the torture and the demon, for lack of a better term, that you put up with it. How far off am I there?
Not at all. I mean, it was torture every day. Like I said, I just dealt with it. I actually allowed him to drink and drink more just so he would pass out, so I wouldn't have to put up with the abuse, or my children wouldn't. But then again, you're kind of putting yourself in a position where 75% of the time he would pass out, but then the other 25%, it made him a lot worse. But you find ways to try to go around that. And like I said, when I went to the class, everything was right in front of me, and it was so classic. It was such just all there. Every single point, every single thing that he had done to me was in the book. And it just made me sit there and think, and everyone around me just said, well, you know what, you're here. and you're facing it now, and the best thing is that you're aware of it. And I wasn't aware of it. I thought, you know, I did something wrong. I thought I could fix it. I always thought I could beat this. And I couldn't, because I couldn't be that person. I wasn't an abuser. I was a victim. So I finally realized that it wasn't me. I wasn't crazy. There was nothing that I could have done, because if it wasn't me, it was going to be somebody else.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is protected. She's living in seclusion. I'm calling her Jane, and we're talking about being a victim. Your husband raped you. You've been to hell and back, but there were times, and it's so easy to sit here, Jane, and talk on the radio to you about love and marriage and the good times and the vows and all this sort of stuff. But when it starts to turn catastrophic, when it starts to turn so ugly, so vile, that you don't know. Again, we talked about the blame game. We talked about torture, living it, putting up with it, survival techniques. How did you finally get help or call for help?
Well, the actual date when he did do it, there was no turning back. It was so extreme and so horrific that I had no choice. I was beaten and bloodied, and I had to go to the hospital. They did CAT scans and x-rays. It got to the point where I didn't understand anything. I didn't understand why he did it, necessarily how it was planned out so well. It kind of just threw me into a position where I was totally confused. But the police report even stated that he basically confessed to what he did. So even in, like, when we went to the court, it was basically on paper. It was documented that he did what he raped me. He stated, I handcuffed her, I beat her. It was all right in front of me. But still, people that I knew or people that have heard anything still blamed me and judged me, even though he had stated he did what he did. I was still being victimized in my own hometown, even though the evidence was right in front of their face.
Some people call it a cliche. I don't. I think it's the God's honest truth that when a rape victim is raped and then has to go through the system, the medical exams, the police reports, the preliminary hearings, the grand jury hearings, testifying on the stand, and without, trying to sound ignorant at all, that rape victim gets raped over and over and over again. Your thoughts?
I'm still being victimized and raped over and over again, and through the system, through my family, friends, and everything. And even though I'm in hiding, and even though it's years after the fact, it's going to affect me and my children for the rest of my life, our lives.
You're afraid for your life and the life of your children?
Yes, I am. I will be afraid for the rest of my life.
Do you sleep well?
Not anymore, no. I mean, I did for a while he was in jail. But now that he's out, I'm back to square one. I'm back to feeling unsafe. I'm back to basically being told, well, you know what, he's a human being. He's allowed to, start his life over, even though I can't even start my life over because I'm in hiding and my life is in limbo because I don't know what his plans are towards me or the children. I'm going through legal processes. As of now, nothing has gone on for me. My life has still been... He's basically still controlling my life after jail and even now as we speak.
The system, in my opinion, and I'm not going to get into specifics of your case because my audience only needs to know you as Jane and that you're living in seclusion, but the system, in my opinion, totally failed you. The system, in my opinion, in a lot of cases, including yours, are so quick to settle, are so quick to... Okay, let's get this done. We can say we did something. We can say he went to jail. It's not the point that he went to jail for a little while and continued to break laws while in jail, but the system failed. We hear about mandatory or maximum sentences in law, whether it's a penal code or the criminal code, but very seldom do we actually see those sentences enacted. Let's talk about the system a little bit. And when I say the system failed you, do you agree?
I fully agree. And I'm going through it as we speak still to this day. So, I mean, I'm sitting here fighting for my own rights as an individual, my own rights as a victim. In the beginning, they told me, you know, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And I've never seen any of it. And it boiled down to basically them just winning their case. And after that, they didn't care what happened to me.
Let's talk about the police. The police, you know, I'm a police officer, besides doing this show. And I look at the education of police officers and the way that crimes are investigated from the time I started till the time I'm working today. It has improved 1,000%, but yet there's still that black mark on law enforcement, that not understanding the rape victim, not understanding the crime of rape, not looking at the victim as a victim. And you have to wonder, Jane, how many cases don't get reported because of that, because that victim doesn't want to be re-victimized. It comes down to just who has the rights and who doesn't.
I fully agree. I understand 100% why no one comes forward. Personally, it has been like a part-time job for me just to put myself in these shoes and go forward with this whole process. I have been nothing but ridiculed about everything, and I'm glad I put it out there. I'm glad that right now, and what I can say is that, as we call it, we're putting the light on the crime, and the crime is what's going to speak for itself.
Right.
Everyone can sit there and make their own opinion and state that I'm wrong or I did something wrong, but it is in the police reports. Everything is there. He went to jail. So if I'm going to sit here and talk about it anymore, I don't want to be the victim anymore. I'd rather everyone know and see what he did, and if they still have their own opinion, then that's their opinion, and they have to live with that. But I'm sick and tired of living as a victim, and I'm going to go on with my life and be a better person.
You know, guts and courage are two terms that I can use to describe you right now, but this question is probably the question that I've been the most reluctant to ask, but I think it's important because it's a huge aspect of being a victim, and in fact, being a victim of rape. As a young person, old person, middle-aged person, I don't give a damn what you are. You always think about your life and carrying on with life. You were in a relationship that turned as nasty and as ugly and as rotten as it possibly could. Has that relationship now deterred you from living your life with another person, or is Jane now on her own protecting herself and her children?
I'm definitely, I haven't dated anybody since. I'm not interested. First of all, it puts that person in jeopardy because he told me that he would kill me or anyone that I dated. So I would hate to put any other person in jeopardy besides what is already there. As to the future, right now, my whole objective is just to start anew, to further my career, further my education, and to be the best mother that I can be, and just protect, you know, myself and my children, and move on in a safe way. But it's just a process. It's a huge process, and thank God gave me the ability with patience, because it's an extremely long process. But every step of the way, there's a little light that I see at the end of the tunnel. So sooner I get there, the better I will be. But until then, it's definitely a
problem. There's a rape victim listening to this program live tonight, or you know, in replay later, and they hear me ask you the question, Jane. If you have advice for that person about coming forward, about saying what happened, about standing up for their rights, what would that advice be?
Well, I mean, that's a hard, you know, thing to put out there, but I would definitely say something. The more you keep it inside, I know it's harder to keep it inside. The more you talk about it, the more you get help. It does help you understand why someone would do this and the effects. And if you didn't come forward, then unfortunately it's going to happen to someone else. and that's going to be hanging over your shoulders as well. As well as there's no reason to hide what someone else did. It's not your fault. You are not guilty, and you don't have to live with the fact that you did this. Someone else did this, and that you should make yourself come forward and just be honest and tell the truth, and you will eventually get through it, and that person will pay for their crime.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said that better myself. Ma'am, you are a strong person. You have a lot of courage. You have a lot of compassion for others, obviously. You are a person, and this is my last question to you this evening, who is in fear for her life and the life of her children. If you were able to say something as far as a victim impact statement, this isn't a court of law, this is my program, in 30 seconds to the people, as far as, again, I don't want you to get into specifics as far as your case, but as far as being a victim, and what people don't understand about impact statements is that how the crime impacted you, what would that be?
That's a difficult question. I'm not exactly sure how to fully answer that, but it impacted my whole life. It changed my whole life. But I can honestly say that living with it was the hardest thing. And living without it, even though I am in hiding and, things are hard right now, it is so much better. My life is so much happier. So even though I made that process through what happened, I'm going to end up being a better person because of it, because I lived through it, and I know how important life is and loving my children and my life. And I'm just thankful that I have a strong family that is behind me and supports me, and my children fully are my heart.
For sure. Jane, stay safe, live happy, and of course, if you need anything, you know how to contact me.
Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're going to be back in a minute with an interesting character. His name is Scott Michaels. If you go to his webpage, www.findadeath.com, don't let that scare you. You'll see fascinating stories about celebrities, their lives, how they died. And, of course, if you're in the Los Angeles area, go on the Dearly Departed tour. It's 3 hours of fun and information about those in Hollywood land that have died. He is Scott Michaels, and he is producing a new Charles Manson documentary, and I thought I would sit down with Scott and have him tell you about it. We talked just earlier today. Okay, we're back. You'll know my next guest from his appearances on E! Entertainment Channel, and of course his website at www.findadeath.com, and of course he's behind the Dearly Departed tours in Los Angeles. Scott Michaels is here. I want to talk to him about this new Charles Manson Helter Skelter documentary that's coming up. Hi, Scott.
How's it going, Dana? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Welcome back to the program. Of course, you know, when you hear the website findadeath.com, people will say, ooh, I'm not going there. But you know what? Once you get there, it's hard not to look at every single thing that you've got there, myself included.
Yeah, it's funny, Dad. I mean, the idea really puts people off. And if they gave it just a second, you know, the odds are they would find out it's not what they're thinking, you know. It happens to me a lot with my tour bus. It says Dearly Departed Tours on it. And I get hate mail and I get hate phone calls, and I just think, well, you don't even know what I do. You're just guessing. So, yeah, people give it a chance. Generally, they'll see that it's actually a decent resource.
The information is fascinating. In fact, a couple of weeks ago on my program, somebody started talking about Aunt B from Andy Griffith's show. And I responded back to my listener. I said, you know, go to this webpage, findadeath.com, and look up Frances Bavier, and you'll learn a little bit more about her. You know, I got about 15 emails back saying, wow, what a cool website. And I thought, you know, it's time to have Scott back on the program again, because you've got everybody from Aunt B, from Andy Griffith, to you name it, it's on there.
Yeah, I try. I mean, it's a small list, but it's growing steadily, and finally that has been falling to the wayside while I've been working on this documentary, but hopefully I'll get back cracking on it again soon.
The Helter Skelter documentary about a year and a half ago, Charles Manson was up for parole again, and I did a little commentary on my website that I do daily, and I talked about Manson and how I was surprised that not the fact that he was denied parole once again, but that he's still alive, because usually these types of serial criminals meet their own demise in jail. And that ended up on YouTube, and about 60, 70, 80,000 hits later, I started getting weird email, and the weird comments were coming up there that there are a lot of people out there that still like Mr. Manson.
Yeah, it's a dark place that the Manson murders. I find them fascinating. I'm obsessed with them. But there are still strong supporters, and you know, people often ask me, if you could meet Charles Manson, what would you ask him? It's like, I don't want to meet him. I want nothing to do with him. You know, he is sort of what he's become, America's boogeyman. He really has.
Exactly.
And he lives up to that. But the people that follow him are scarier than he himself, I think.
Refresh my memory. One is a chance to get out on parole because of medical reasons. At least I've seen that
right,
in the news.
Susan Atkins, who actually said to Sharon Tate, as she was pleading for the life of herself and her child that she was carrying, Susan said, she said, "Look, bitch, I have no mercy for you. You're going to die, and there's nothing you can do about it."
Yeah.
Proceeded to stab her.
Class act. Bad health or not, there's someone that should stay in jail for the rest of her life, just like she took Sharon Tate's and Sharon Tate's baby's life. Tell us about the documentary.
Well, the documentary is it's almost 2 hours long now, and it basically shows the places in Los Angeles and Death Valley that the Manson and London and all the places the Manson murder sort of touched, be that where the actual murders occurred, or where the people that were involved with the murders lived, where they spent their normal days, where Sharon and Roma got married. You know, it's just sort of it's all the stuff that I just thought was important to the case. It still exists for the most part, and it's interesting to take a walk through these places 39 years later and see what they look like. And my particular interest is the Manson murders. I'm sort of obsessed with it. I'm not an expert. A lot of people sort of refer to me as an expert, and I'm not. I know a lot about it, but there's so many more people that know so much more about it. But this is my little effort to historically document these locations while they still exist.
You know, I think it's the Spahn Ranch that's now owned by a church, I believe, or at least the property is owned by a church. And I see the clip. And again, go to findadeath.com, and you'll see a little YouTube clip of the documentary that Scott is working on, where you go there and you're finding old hubcaps from probably stolen cars from the, you know, 60s, early, you know, late 60s, I guess. It has to be somewhat eerie, too, to, you know, tie in. And I know you do a great job of it on video, you know, the cave and what it looked like then, what it looks like now, to the little shack where he was found hiding under the sink, I believe. It's got to be eerie to be there.
It is. I mean, when you're actually walking in those footsteps and to know that the last place the family actually, you know, romped around like they thought they owned the world and they were going to conquer it, we're in these places. And there is something to be said. I mean, because generally on the weekend of the anniversary or on the night of the anniversary, a group of friends of mine and I will go up to the El Coyote where Sharon Tate had their last supper, and then we go up to the house where the house used to be. Now, the house is gone now, but the road, it all looks pretty much the way it did in 69, so it's actually exceptionally chilling to be walking up that road at that time of day on the exact anniversary to know that the killer did the exact same thing. It's quite eerie. It really is. And when we went out to the Barker Ranch where they were arrested, you know, there are still supporters of Manson that go out there, and there's still pro-Manson sort of paraphernalia laying around. Manson still has an active website. He has active followers and still scares the hell out of me, to be honest with you.
Yeah, America's boogeyman, I think, is a good term for him. You know, we touched on it a little bit at the beginning of the interview, talking about the public. The public, here's a website, findadeath.com. No way, I'm not going there. And then when they get there, they can't leave. Same thing has to do with Charles Manson, Helter Skelter, all that sort of stuff. Let's talk about the public's fascination with these high-profile cases, because, you know, this is one that will live on in infamy.
Yeah, well, I think the part of the reason that is because the Tate murders, the Tate-LaBianca murders, and they aren't actually isolated to those seven victims on those two nights, but there are, they can actually attribute up to possibly 30 victims to these people. But between those victims and those murderers, you can actually, I think, tie them within 6 degrees to almost every important event in history. Well, not in history, but in 60s history. I mean, you know, you can directly attach the Beach Boys and the Mamas and the Papas to the murderers. You know, these people partied together. And to think that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski had dinner with Bobby Kennedy the night before he was assassinated. And, you know, there's so many aspects of this case that are interesting, I think. The fact that Roman Polanski first accused John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas as being the murderer. He really thought John Phillips killed his wife and unborn baby. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also find it fascinating that the sheet music to Straight Shooter, the Mamas and Papas song, was actually on the piano that was in the living room of the Tate house at the time. You know, it's just that the minutia of it is so fascinating to me, and I'm always learning something new. It's just... it's addictive. It really is.
Yeah, addictive is a good term for it. And in fact, something that's addictive for many people, and I think you probably wish more, is Dearly Departed tours. Let's talk about that.
No, I can't complain. I've got my little tour bus, and I go 5 days a week, and I have a decent job. I like my job, and I meet some of the nicest people in the world, and people like what I do, and they ask me to participate in shows like your nice show, Dana, and others. So, I have a pretty good life. Yeah, it'd be nice to be a bit more comfortable financially, but I'm happier than most of the people I know that are.
The folks that go on the Dearly Departed tour, just give us a little synopsis what they may see.
Well, the Dearly Departed covers about 30 miles, and it lasts over 3 hours, and you'll see the locations that have to do with the Tate-LaBianca murders. You'll see where the Menendez murders happened. You'll see where Rebecca Schaefer was killed by a stalker. But also, you'll see, houses where, like, Lucy lived when she died, and the corner where William Frawley from I Love Lucy dropped dead, and plus you'll see movie locations from Grease and Sunset Boulevard. I try to keep it light. The Dearly Departed tour I call a lighthearted look at the dark side of Hollywood. I do offer a Helter Skelter tour a couple of times a month, which is just devoted to the Manson murders, and that's considerably less lighthearted. It's a bit intense, and it's a lot of work to do that tour, but I try really hard to make an accurate portrayal of what happened, and I take people to where the events happened here in Los Angeles. So because I was obsessed with them, I thought, well, certainly there has to be others, and it's not a tour that's going to, that I'm going to be able to run on a steady basis, because there's not that much interest, but enough to run a couple of tours a month. And my next stop, the next thing I'm starting on is the Hollywood Movie Location Tour, where in my bus I have a large television, and I can show movies in my bus. I just got the rights to do that. And while I'm showing the movies, I can actually pull up to the location where the movie was shot. So that'll be launched probably in July, so I'm very excited about that.
Absolutely. When will we see the documentary?
Well, we just finished the voiceover work on the documentary probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, and hopefully, fingers crossed, well, certainly by July, the end of July, for the anniversary, it'll absolutely be out, which is August 8th. I mean, it was supposed to be out last year, but a number of events occurred that prohibited from doing it before Christmas. So it'll be out before the anniversary, August 8th of this year, for sure.
Now, it seems like, just one last question before I let you go, there's never a loss, especially at Christmas time. It's really strange for celebrities that pass on. How do you pick which ones to put on your website?
Well, I mean, it's something that has to kind of strike an interest with me. I'll watch a TV show, and I'll see somebody, and I'll think, oh, what's that all about? And then I'll go for it. For instance, this is just something off the top of my head, but I saw a movie at the theater called Mulholland Drive. It was a David Lynch movie. At the end of the movie, I noticed that this film was dedicated to Jennifer Syme. And I thought, who's Jennifer Syme? So I looked her up on the internet. Turns out that it was Keanu Reeves' girlfriend. And then I got the whole deal about the party at Marilyn Manson's house and how she flipped her car doing 50 on a very wet, on a very curved road, and died that way. So it's one of those things that something strikes a chord within my brain, and I kind of go, that's interesting, and I do a little bit of research, and And lo and behold, there comes an interesting story out of it. Everyone's got an interesting story, but I don't know. Not everyone has a film dedicated to them either. So, you know, that's the kind of thing. It just interests me, and then I pursue it that way.
Absolutely. The website is www.findadeath.com. And, of course, when you're in Los Angeles, Dearly Departed Tours, you can find information on that website, too. Thanks, Scott. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Dana, for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's Scott Michaels from findadeath.com. We'll be right back. And we are right back, and I want to thank my guests this evening and remind you that our webpage is located at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. If you can't listen to the show live, you can listen to an archive of shows, tonight's shows, and many other shows there, and of course, my daily commentary. You can leave comments or whatever. Thank you to all my guests, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.